Our first case this morning is United States against Wilson, and you may want to try out that mic first, just see what this is.
I think it's working.
All right, you may proceed.
Hey, please, the court. Good morning. My name is Major Rick Ballas, and I represent the appellant, Oscar Newman Wilson. In this case, Judge Efron, with your permission, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
That's granted.
Words have meaning and effect. Often, the particularized meaning of words and their effect depend on the world or the community in which those words are spoken or written. For example, if we were to be in any city park in the United Kingdom, went up to some of the local boys or girls and asked them if they wanted to join us in a game of football, the next thing that would happen would be someone would break out what Americans call a soccer ball, we'd be playing a game of soccer. Why is that? Because in the United Kingdom, the word football has a very clear and precise meaning. If you were to pose that same question to some local kids here in any city park in the District of Columbia, next thing that would happen would be someone would break out the old pigskin. We'd be playing the game of football like the Redskins play every fall on Sundays. In the world of military justice, words have very precise meaning and legal effect. Because of that, care must be taken in the selection of words that are used, and care must be taken in the drafting of legal documents. In this case, the words used by the commanding authority in the action are both clear and unambiguous. The legal effect of those words is that the dishonorable discharge, which was adjudged in the appellant's case, was not approved.
Counsel, can I ask you just a couple of questions?
Absolutely.
First of all, in your view, does 1107D or 1107F4 govern what needs to be in the convening authority's action?
D1 tells us that the convening authority may, for any reason or no reason at all, modify, approve, disapprove any portion of the law. And 1107F tells us exactly what needs to be in the convening authority's action, such as it needs to be signed in writing personally by the convening authority. If any portion of the findings are going to be disapproved, they need to be specified. Anything that's going to be done to the sentence needs to be explicitly stated.
Okay, let me ask it a slightly different way. Section 1107D is subtitled Action on the Sentence, and 1107F is subtitled Contents of Action and Related Matters. Which of those subsections of 1107, in your view, governs what needs to be in the convening authority's action?
1107B1 simply is spelling out what the convening authority's powers are, and then the action, what it must contain, is contained in 1107F. Under 1107B1, as I just stated, the convening authority has absolute power to modify, approve, disapprove any portion of the lawfully adjudged sentence. The only requirement under D1, 1107D1, is that whatever action the convening authority does decide to take in the case, it must be explicitly stated. This court has echoed that as recently as United States versus Polite, for this court held that because of the importance and all that is affected by the convening authority's action, whatever action is taken by the convening authority, it must be clear and unambiguous. And that's what happened in this case. The language used by the convening authority in the action is clear and unambiguous, and this court should give plain meaning to those words and their legal effect. Now, had the convening authority wanted to do something different, that is to approve the dishonorable discharge or mitigate it to a bad conduct discharge, all you had to simply do was look to model form for action number 12 in the MCM, cut and paste it into his Word document, and fill in the appropriate blanks. That was not done in this case. We had the language which clearly states, obviously there's no dispute with the fact that all confinement in excess of 3 years and 3 months is disapproved. And the convening authority writes the remainder of the sentence, comma, with the exception of the dishonorable discharge, is approved.
So the first sentence disapproves something and the second sentence approves something. And the government, I think, is arguing that that leaves the dishonorable discharge neither in the disapprove or the approved sentence. Is that a source of ambiguity?
No. Appellant's position is a plain reading of that sentence. It says clearly, the remainder of the sentence, with the exception of the dishonorable discharge, is approved, which means total forfeitures are approved, reduction to E1 is approved, and all confinement in 3 years and 3 months of confinement is approved. That's what the plain language of the paragraph dealing with the sentence approval is talking about.
But the convening authority has expressly disapproved something before, so in theory he knows how to do it, and he hasn't done it with anything other than the 3 years and 3 months.
Certainly there is innumerable permutations that the convening authority could have used with the selection of language. However, we have to assume that the convening authority meant what words he put down here. And those words simply say, in plain meaning, is that the remainder of the sentence, with the exception of the dishonorable discharge, is approved. So that means that forfeitures are approved, reduction to E1 is approved, but the dishonorable discharge is not. Certainly the convening authority, had he wanted to approve the dishonorable discharge, could have said all confinement in excess of 3 years and 3 months is disapproved, and the remainder of the sentence is approved, comma, with the exception of the dishonorable discharge, and will be ordered executed.
Okay, we've got an affidavit from the convening authority, albeit some years later, saying he intended to.
Wait, is the affidavit before the court?
It's not.
Why is it not?
It was not because this court ruled that it would not be allowed to be attached at this point in the game. It's also important.
Counsel, which model form were you referring to?
Probably model form for action number 12 would be the best one had the convening authority wanted to approve the dishonorable discharge in this case.
Has this court said that that model form is a good form to use? Or have we in our more recent cases suggested that the grammatical structure of that form lends itself to problems?
I think the latter, sir.
Trying to combine too many different ideas in one sentence.
And I don't recall the one that was suggested. It was also out of Appendix 16, whether it was the Polito or the Gasser decision.
Yeah.
However, that form, model form for action number 12, if it was the convening authority's intent to approve the dishonorable discharge, would have accomplished that or a slight variation thereof. It's also important to note that there's no evidence in the record to indicate we're dealing with a newly stood-up command that's unfamiliar with matters of military justice.
Is that relevant in your view?
Well, it's appellant's first position that the plain meaning of the words used are unambiguous. If this court does determine that there are red flags, that is, the action may be ambiguous, that is subject to more than one meaning, or there's documents in the record that make it inconsistent with what's in the action, then this court can look to the entire record of trial and try and glean the commander's intent. Appellant's position simply is that these were not rookie mistakes, if there were mistakes at all. This was an experienced convening authority with all the powers of general court martial convening authority being advised by an experienced staff advocate and maybe Lieutenant Commander O'Fura.
Is this like the parole evidence rule in contracts? That seems to be what you're saying.
It's been a few years since I've studied that contract.
Well, you don't let extraneous evidence in if the writing is clear and you can interpret it from its four corners.
Absolutely. And it's appellant's position that the language used by this convening authority is plain and that this court should do what this court has done in the past, as well as every other appellant court that comes with a statute or a regulation that's at issue. You look at the rules that are used, give them plain meaning, and if that makes sense, then that's what you have to assume the drafter of that document or those words meant when they chose those words.
Counsel, does it matter in this case that having disapproved part of the sentence of confinement, that the convening authority's action did not specifically approve the dishonorable discharge, which is a different issue than whether or not he disapproved it?
Correct. Those would be two different issues, and it's appellant's position that the language used in this convening authority's action, when it talks about the remainder of the sentence, comma, with the exception of the dishonorable discharge, is approved. And that means that the dishonorable discharge is not approved, because the commander is talking about the remainder of the sentence as being approved. Had he simply wanted to say, the remainder of the sentence is approved, comma, with the exception of the dishonorable discharge is executed, that would be a completely different ballgame. That's not what we have here.
So just to be clear, is your argument that it was specifically disapproved, or is your argument that it wasn't approved?
That it was disapproved by the language used in this action.
Okay, turn to the other argument, which is that it was not specifically approved, which under my reading of 1107F4 is an alternative argument that you could make. Have you looked at that argument?
Yes, we can probably believe that that's a weaker argument, and it's not the argument that we're relying on. D1 specifically says whatever action the convening authority takes must be explicitly stated. So we look at that. If the convening authority wanted to approve the dishonorable discharge, he could have said, he should have said something differently. If there are no further questions, this concludes appellant's argument.
Thank you, counsel.
Counsel for the government.
States government. Neither the government nor the defense can say with credibility that the language of the convening authority's action in this case explicitly approves or disapproves a dishonorable discharge. But this court's precedent establishes that we can look outside the four corners of the convening authority's action to determine his intent. When we do this, we find that the convening authority's intent is evident that he approved the dishonorable discharge. The only reasonable alternative to this conclusion would be to send this back to the convening authority for clarification. This court in United States versus McDaniel held that a convening authority had implicitly approved an adjudged punitive discharge even though he made no explicit statement approving the discharge. Here, as in McDonald, the only reasonable interpretation of the convening authority's action includes approval of a punitive discharge. The reasonableness is evident when this court, as it did in Loft, considers the convening authority's intent outside of the four corners of the action's language. Loft determined that the appellate courts could use surrounding documentation to interpret an otherwise unclear convening authority's action. And in Loft, this court examined surrounding documentation such as the pretrial agreement, the staff judge advocate recommendation, and proposed convening authority's action to suspend the bad conduct discharge to determine if they may shed light on a convening authority's intentions. A thorough examination of that surrounding documentation led this court to conclude that the convening authority intended to approve the bad conduct discharge. Likewise, in United States versus Blight, this court examined the pretrial agreement, the staff judge advocate recommendation, and the clemency, and that the defense did not request a disapproval of the bad conduct discharge, only suspension.
Let me ask you a question. In the ordinary case, do you need to look at the staff judge advocate recommendation in order to analyze what's in a convening authority's action?
No, Your Honor.
So it has independent legal effect without those other documents in ordinary case?
You should not have to, in an ordinary case, look at surrounding documentation.
And can you tell me what language, if any, you rely on in the convening authority's action in this case for the proposition that the convening authority approved the dishonorable discharge?
Examining the convening authority's, the syntax of the sentence in the convening authority's action, we see that the convening authority is explicit in what it disapproves, and that is confinement in excess of 3 years and 3 months. And then we see that, for the most part, it's explicit in what it approves, which is the remainder of the sentence. The only part that is left untouched by the convening authority's action is the dishonorable discharge. It's simply unclear, and in fact, almost neutral as to what to do with the dishonorable discharge. And when we have a case like this, as precedent shows, what we need to do is to examine the convening authority duties intent by looking at the outside activities to determine what that intent is. Now, first, despite three clemency requests, the appellant never once requested that the convening authority disapprove the punitive discharge in this case, where he raped a victim, assaulted a victim, unlawfully entered her home, and committed adultery.
I mean, those factors all go to whether a dishonorable discharge would have been an appropriate sentence in the first instance, right? Not to whether we look at the convening authority's action and find whether that it actually approves a dishonorable discharge.
What we're looking at is whether or not it's reasonable to believe that the convening authority would have approved the dishonorable discharge, and we look at the clemency request as we did in previous cases, in addition to a number of other things, such as the staff judge advocate's recommendations, and we look at the context or the seriousness of the offenses. So beginning with the fact that this was a very serious crime, one that involved a rape and assault and an unlawful entry into a house and an adultery, and the fact that the appellant himself never requested that the punitive discharge be, never requested that the community authority not approve the, disprove the punitive discharge, excuse me. It's a far cry now that he's stating that the community authority intended to disapprove something that he never requested.
Well, let me ask you a question, which is, could we agree with you that the offenses in this case were very serious and that the appellant never requested that his dishonorable discharge not be approved, and still find that the convening authority nonetheless, for whatever reason, decided to disapprove the dishonorable discharge in the convening authority's action?
Not on the facts of this case, Your Honor. What we have here is the convening authority dealing with what he's going to do in separate sections. First, he deals with what he's going to approve. Excuse me, what he's going to disapprove. And what he disapproved was everything except 3 years and 3 months of that sentence. He deals with that completely different, completely separately than what he ends up approving, which is the remainder of the sentence.
With the exception of the dishonorable discharge,
yes,
is what it says.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
That's what it says, with the exception of the dishonorable discharge.
Yes, Your Honor.
So he didn't specifically approve the dishonorable discharge.
Exactly, Your Honor. He did not specifically approve it, and he did not specifically disapprove it.
Counsel, has the government changed its position from the time that the brief was filed? As I read the brief, the government's requesting that we remand the case for corrected action.
Yes, Your Honor, and if this court determines that either the community authority's language is ambiguous or incomplete, then that is the right thing to do. We should remand this case back to the community authority.
Well, that appears to be the position of the government in the brief, is it not?
Yes, Your Honor, it is the position of the government. However, we also filed a letter to file supplemental authorities that stand for the proposition that this court can also look at the reasonableness of the community authority's intent in determining whether or not he intended to approve or disapprove the punitive discharge.
So the government wants to use the authority to file a supplemental authority as a means of changing its brief?
No, Your Honor.
Is there any authority for you to do that?
No, Your Honor. If we examine the brief itself, we will see that the government did argue that the community authority's action is either incomplete or ambiguous. We also looked at whether or not the convening authority's surrounding documentation would lend us to believe that the convening authority's intent was to disapprove the bad conduct discharge.
Well, what does, on page 6, does not clearly reflect his intent to approve the adjudged dishonorable discharge must therefore be corrected mean? Does that mean that the government believes that the action needs to be corrected, or does the government believe that we can affirm without sending it back for correction?
The ultimate and the stronger argument, Your Honor, would be that this court should remand this back to the community authority for clarification. However, due to prior precedents of this court can look at surrounding documentation to determine the community authority's intent. Excuse me. Now, while it's clear that the convening authority's action is incorrect in form and that it does not comport to the model forms for action contained in Appendix 16, it's important to note that the convening authority's action also does not comport to the model forms for disapproving a punitive discharge. The language alone, as stated above, is neutral. If this court, however, finds that the convening authority's intent is unclear as to what to do with regard to the dishonorable discharge, then as we stated earlier, the right thing to do would be to return it back for clarification. There is no harm in sending this convening authority's back. If the convening authority intends to disapprove the dishonorable discharge, as the appellant suggests, then in no uncertain terms, the convening authority should state that the discharge is disapproved.
Is there any reason why the government didn't just suggest that to the Court of Criminal Appeals so that this case could have been disposed of quite a bit of time ago?
Unfortunately, Your Honor, this was not a question posed to the Court of Criminal Appeals. Okay.
Counsel, I have a slightly different question. Assuming that we disagree with you and find that the convening authority's action is not ambiguous, is there any authority, in your view, for us to nonetheless send it back to the convening authority for different action because he meant to do something different?
Well, if we find that the convening authority's action is also incomplete, we can send it back.
Okay, so explain how it's incomplete.
It's incomplete in that it does not either approve or disapprove a punitive discharge.
And what authority are you relying on for the proposition that it must do that?
The same. RCM 1107 discusses that if the community authority's action is either ambiguous or incomplete, then we can remand back to the community authority for clarification.
I understand that that's the authority that we could do it if it was incomplete. I'm asking for authority that would suggest that the fact it wasn't specifically approved, that the dishonorable discharge was not specifically approved or disapproved, makes it incomplete.
But the convening authority must explicitly state whether or not it approves or disapproves.
Okay, and and you're relying on 1107D for that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and so I'll ask you the same question I asked appellant's counsel, which is it 1107D or 1107F that dictates what has to be in the convening authority's action?
Your Honor, I'd argue that both this dictate. 1107F specifically states that the action shall state whether the sentence adjudged by the court martial is approved.
Okay, so that means that they would need to specifically approve a dishonorable discharge, and I think we all agree that that did not happen.
Yes, Your Honor. And then if we go to 1107D, it states that a convening authority's action shall be explicit. The approval of or disapproval should be explicitly stated.
Okay, and that's talking about action on the sentence, and 1107F is talking about contents of action and related matters.
Yes, Your Honor.
So which of those sections trumps in terms of what needs to be in the action?
Well, Your Honor, that's difficult to say which trumps. They both need to be in the action. However, 1107D1 specifically states that the approval or disapproval should be explicitly stated. So in this case, the disapproval and the disapproval was not explicitly stated as it relates to the dishonorable discharge.
How do you deal with the language in 1107F4 that says that if only part of the sentence is approved, the action shall state which parts are approved?
Your Honor, the community authority, for the most part, and with the exception of the dishonorable discharge, did specifically state which part should be approved. The problem is it did not specifically state which part it was disapproved pursuant to 1107D1.
So you're relying on D1 rather than F4.
Sounds like a bingo. In terms of how we treat the dishonorable discharge, yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
In terms of what the community authority was supposed to do, I'm relying on both. If there are no further questions, and in light of the foregoing, we respectfully request that you find that the convening authority's action was clear on its intent. Alternatively, if the court finds that the convening authority's action was ambiguous, we request that you return your action back to the convening authority for clarification.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Yes, sir. This court has repeatedly held, probably United States versus Wheelis is the most recent citing, that the accused's best chance for clemency rests with the convening authority right before that convening authority takes action. This court should not second-guess the commander's plenary power to approve, disapprove, or modify in part any portion of the lawful judge's sentence. It's appellant's position that the plain language used in this convening of authority's action is clear and unambiguous that the dishonorable discharge was not approved. And secondly, this convening authority's action is not incomplete within the meaning of 1107. If it was incomplete, that would mean it was missing something that was in the action, that should have been in the action and wasn't. This convening authority's action has all the language that is necessary to comply with 1107. The plain meaning of the words used should be relied upon, and that the dishonorable discharge was not approved.
And with respect to D1, when it says the approval or disapproval shall be explicitly stated, what's your response?
It is explicitly stated by the language used in this action.
I see. I check. I see where you're going with that. Thank you.
So your view is that the provisions of the manual are not in conflict with each other, but that the convening authority's action complied with every aspect of the manual that was required.
That is the appellant's position.
And if that's not the case, then your alternative is to join the government in the remand.
No.
Now,
all that position would be, let's look to the entire record of trial outside the four corners of the document to glean the commander's intent, and that's where appellant would rely on all the details listed in our brief, how compelling and detailed clemency submissions were submitted on behalf of the appellant, how this convening authority indicated he not only read the S-jar and the results of trial, but the entire record of trial, so he was familiar with how that these facts were a little bit unusual.
Counsel, it seems to me that you have a couple different arguments that you could be making, and the one that you're making now is somewhat perplexing, because you could either argue, as you just conceded to Chief Judge Efron, that you can reconcile 1107F4 and 1107D.
Yes.
So that's one argument you can make, and you can say that it complies with both because it specifically approves and disapproves the sentence as both sections require, correct?
Yes.
Or you could make the alternative argument, which is that if you have to choose between the two, 1107F4, which specifically talks about what needs to be in the convening authority's action, trumps 1107D with respect to what has to be in the convening authority's action. So I guess what I wonder is, do you think that that isn't an argument that you can make?
No, it's appellant's fallback position that if the convening authority's action does not comply with all the requirements of 1107F4, then the court can look to all the documentation in the record of trial to glean that commander's intent before it would order the case to be remanded for corrective action. And if only the court cannot glean the commander's intent, then at that point, the only remedy for this court would be to remand it to the convening authority for a substituted and corrective action.
With respect to that first part, reviewing the record as a whole, without asking you to concede that this is determinative, is there any reason why it wouldn't be appropriate for us to look at the specificity of the appellant's request for clemency?
No, the appellant concedes that his trial defense counsel did not ask to disapprove.
Okay, that answers my question. And secondly, again, in terms of the relief you're requesting, as I look on page 20 of your brief, your first request is that we disapprove the dishonorable discharge. Your second request in the alternative, and I recognize it's an alternative request, is that we order a new convening authority's action, which is the same request that the government has made in this case. Okay, thank you.
If there are no further questions, that concludes appellant's argument.
Thanks. We thank both parties for your presentation today. And let's see if I can... We will convene on the Jameson case at 9:35.
Thank you.
Our second case this morning is United States against Jameson. This is set for 15 minutes per side. Counsel for the defense.
May it please the court. My name is Lieutenant Brian Weiser. I represent Todd Jameson. Chief Judge Efron, with your permission, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
Granted.
Todd Jameson was involved in a motor vehicle accident nearly 39 years to the day after an intoxicated Armando Schmerber drove his car into a tree in Los Angeles. But that is where the similarities between this case and what the Supreme Court called the special facts in Schmerber ends. In Schmerber, the arresting officer arrived at the scene and smelled alcohol in Schmerber's breath. His eyes were bloodshot, watery, glassy in appearance. He then followed Schmerber to the hospital, where he noticed similar signs of intoxication, and then placed Schmerber under arrest. As the Supreme Court noted in Knowles v. Iowa, there are two historical rationales for the search incident to arrest doctrine upon which Schmerber is based. Those are the need to disarm the suspect and the need to preserve evidence for later use at trial. But the sole justification for a search that is not incident to arrest, or a so-called Terry stop, is the protection of the police officer and others nearby. In this case, Sergeant Volk had reasonable suspicion that appellant may have committed a crime, but that did not permit him to search appellant for anything other than weapons for his safety and the safety of hospital staff that morning. According to Terry, he could not pierce the outer level of appellant's clothing, and according to Schmerber, he certainly could not have pierced appellant's skin. This is perhaps best illustrated in Knowles v. Iowa, where the court invalidated the search of the entire vehicle.
He's saying he couldn't do it with consent?
He certainly could do it with consent, Your Honor, but as appellant addresses in his brief, there was not valid consent in this case. I'm addressing the government's fallback position, which is arguably the strongest position, that Schmerber authorizes this this search, but in fact, ultimately, it does not. In Knowles v. Iowa, the court invalidated a search of the entire passenger compartment of a vehicle pursuant to a Terry stop, a search that would have been admissible had Knowles been involved in arrest, a search incident to arrest. And the Supreme Court in Knowles invalidates what the Supreme Court of Iowa had called a search incident to
arrest. I'm happy to wait, but I have a question about good cause. Are you going to address that?
Good cause, Your Honor? Under Coughlin, Your Honor?
Or under the rule? What's your good cause here?
The good cause
for being able to argue the motion after the plea.
Well, Your Honor, it was counsel's failure to properly investigate this. Specifically, it was counsel's inability to contact the two law enforcement officers. And under the liberal construction doctrine, that should constitute a good cause in this case.
Is a colorable claim or potential claim for ineffective assistance of counsel good cause to allow a motion after the fact? Are you making that argument here, or are you relying solely on the argument that the counsel made before the judge, which is I tried to contact these folks and I didn't get them?
We're relying on trial defense counsel's argument, Your Honor. And as this court said in Coffin, if Coffin is not satisfied, and if there is not good cause, then there is ultimately an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. Under the liberal construction doctrine announced in Coffin, trial defense counsel's stated basis should satisfy the good cause requirement of that case and also of the rule.
Which is your better argument, counsel, your claim that the trial court judge should have permitted them to make the motion then, or your ineffective assistance of counsel claim?
Your Honor, appellant is clearly dealing on the margins of good cause under the first issue. The second argument is certainly the stronger argument, that that the consent was not good in this case, and that there is no alternative basis for this search to have taken place. Under Schmerber or under the North Carolina law, the procedural and evidence provisions, which were inapplicable in this case.
Can you talk to me about how the implied consent law in North Carolina and under the Marine Corps order play into the totality of the circumstances with respect to the voluntariness of the consent?
Well, Your Honor, we know that the federal implied consent statute, which is addressed by the Ninth Circuit in the Chappell case cited by the government, is inapplicable here because it mirrors the language of Schmerber requiring an arrest. So the federal implied consent statute does not apply, and North Carolina's statute certainly would not apply because we're dealing with procedural or evidentiary provisions that would be governed by the military rules of evidence. The important fact that was conveyed to appellant is that if he did not consent to this search, his North Carolina driver's license or his civilian driver's license would be suspended, something that is simply just not the case on the facts of this accident, which was a military service member involved in an accident on a military installation investigated by military law enforcement officers and blood taken at a military hospital. North Carolina law is simply inapplicable on the facts of this case.
What's the jurisdiction in the post?
Your Honor, it's not addressed in the record, so we have to assume that this is a federal crime.
Well, now, is it exclusive? Is it concurrent?
Your Honor, I don't know.
Don't know.
And it is not in the record of trial. The government, if it had intended to rely on this North Carolina statute, it should have placed that in the record, but it ultimately did not. What we're dealing with here is a search incident to the manual for courts martial and under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. And the fact that appellant's driver's license would be suspended in North Carolina should not have been introduced to the appellant. When you combine that with appellant's physical condition, the fact that he was intoxicated, you have all of the indicia that the totality of the circumstances indicate that there was not valid consent in this case.
Counsel, let's put aside the question of implied consent and state law. We have a consent form that's signed here.
Yes, Your Honor.
And do we have any testimony from the appellant as to whether he did or did not consent?
There is no such testimony.
Why shouldn't we take that into account here? That is, there's one person who knows what he was doing at the time that form was put in front of him. And we have no information from that individual. Why isn't that sufficient for us to say at this point, irrespective of state law, implied consent, we got a consent form in front of us. The person who would be in the best position to tell us whether he was drunk or injured or couldn't understand what was going on, he hasn't said anything, so we'll just rely on the form.
You don't need it, Your Honor, because the totality of the circumstances indicates that that the consent in this case was invalid. We know that he was drunk. He doesn't have to take the stand and tell you that he was intoxicated. The blood results come back and tell you that he's drunk. We also know that he had a suspected broken jaw. He was on some sort of pain medication or muscle relaxers, as trial defense counsel refers to it. You have the totality of the circumstances, and then we also have this inducement issue of if you don't consent to our military search, the state of North Carolina is going to take your driver's license.
Why shouldn't we require the person to tell us that, in fact, they were so impaired by alcohol that they couldn't understand what that form was, or they were so induced by the threat of state action that they signed the form on that basis?
Well, Your Honor, this telling you the circumstances, I believe, answers your question. But in this case, we're dealing with the ineffective assistance of counsel. So the individual that was to be appellant's champion at the trial level and perhaps produce that testimony was not properly investigating this case and was effectively denying appellant the opportunity to challenge the government's case. And so in another case, perhaps this court should require that, but not in the context of this case where we're dealing with the failure of counsel to defend appellant properly. It's important to note that last term, the Supreme Court of Virginia in Bristol v. Commonwealth found Schmerber to be inapplicable to situations not involving arrest. And in the only case that this court has addressed Schmerber directly, United States versus Fenton, the first factor noted by this court is that there was an arrest in that case. Again, bringing us back to the point that Schmerber is a search incident to arrest case. But the government on page 16 of its brief argues that courts have generally rejected a requirement that there be a valid arrest before blood is taken. It cites the Chappell case. That statement is a bit of an overstatement. It should correctly state that courts within the Ninth Circuit have generally held that arrest is not a requirement of Schmerber, but no other federal court has followed the Ninth Circuit on that point.
Now, the most important departure from Smoother is the lack of exigent circumstances in this case. You'll recall that November 12, 1964 was a Thursday, and the blood in Smoother was taken at 2 a.m. You will also recall that the court held in that case that there was no time to seek out a magistrate. Compare that with the facts of this case, where the police officers waited 4 or 5 hours on a Monday morning at the hospital before taking appellant's blood. They also, on page 80 of the record, went back to their office before going to the hospital. If there are no further questions, definitely.
Counsel, you can complete your thought here, and we'll be similarly lenient, but not excessively subtle to the government during its argument.
The last point that I wanted to make is that this is very similar to the case of United States versus Porter, the Army Court of Criminal Appeals case, where the accused in that case is taken to the military hospital where he works, and they draw the blood from Porter at that hospital. And the Army Court of Criminal Appeals in that case, it was unreasonable for them not to seek out command search authorization. It's very similar here. They went back to the military police headquarters, a battalion of military policemen, and they can't come up with a search authorization at 10:50 on a Monday morning. If there are no further questions, that concludes my argument.
Thank you. Counsel for the government.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Major Kevin Harris, and I represent the United States this morning. The government intends to address first the issue of good cause, and then the issue specified by the court regarding ineffective assistance of counsel. Turning then first to good cause, we invite the court's attention to the record at 90, where Captain Bowman, the trial defense counsel, lays out with great specificity all of his good cause, which is, sir, the only good cause would be that both of my attempts to interview Sergeant Berwick were unsuccessful, and I haven't had a chance to talk to him before today.
The potential for an IAC claim good cause?
No, Your Honor, it's not.
So if the counsel got up there and said, I didn't do anything to prepare for this case because I was drunk the entire time, and now, since I've sobered up, I want to put in a motion, and the judge says, that's not good cause, sit down. Is there good cause there?
Under those circumstances, yes, it would be good cause, Your Honor.
So as a matter of theory, an IAC claim, the potential for an IAC claim could constitute good cause.
Yes, Your Honor.
Does the government accept that possibility?
Certainly, Your Honor, particularly when that claim is so apparent at trial. Here, what we have...
Why is it not apparent that taking 49 days to interview the critical witnesses who are government officials and doing nothing but leaving a random message with somebody who's not identified isn't at least colorably an IAC problem?
Without jumping into the IAC claim quite yet, Your Honor, IAC has, as the court well knows, two requirements, incompetence and prejudice. The court's example that Judge Baker gave where he was drunk and...
I admit that was an extreme example.
Prejudice there, Your Honor, but here, where, as the judge correctly noted in his ruling in 107 and 108, the counsel was aware of some, if not most, of the facts from having access to his very own client, as was brought up by the questions earlier. He had access to his client. He knew, presumably then, as we presume the competence of counsel, what his client knew and didn't know at the time he signed that consent form. So again, there can be a circumstance, Your Honor, where an ineffective assistance of counsel claim equates good cause for relief from RCM 905 and Military Rule of Evidence 311. We don't have that here. Turning for a second to Coffin and the facts of Coffin, as footnote 3 makes clear in Coffin, it's unclear, for instance, in Coffin, what was before the court. Was it a matter of misinformation from the client? Was it a matter of a lack of diligent investigation? Or was it a matter of prosecutorial sandbagging? Turning back to Judge Baker's question, there can be good cause established when it's clear that it's simply just a lack of diligent investigation. While it's clear there's a lack of diligent investigation here, we don't know ultimately for a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel whether this was going to be a meritorious claim or not.
Well, isn't that why the judge should have opened it up?
No, Your Honor. Because, again, if we continue to travel down that path, the rule will, in essence, become meaningless and without any teeth, if you will. At some point, for instance, in the appellate's brief, he makes issue of the fact that this was a military judge-alone trial, and it would not have been greatly inconvenient for the trial court to open it up. However, as the court made clear in Coffin, it's the efficient administration of justice that is being upheld by RCM 905 and Military Rule 11.
Why is it efficient to litigate an IAC claim for the next 6 years in the appellate process?
It is not efficient, Your Honor, but it is equally inefficient to allow the trial counsel to make his opening statement, begin the presentation of evidence, set up the logistics for a trial with the understanding that the blood alcohol consent was not going to be objected to on Fourth Amendment grounds.
But the one inconvenience is the judge for 10 minutes or half an hour, the other takes 6 years. I think there's a proportionality issue here.
Well, the government would take issue with the fact that it's only going to take 10 minutes. Again, under the circumstances we have in this case, we don't know because, again, there's more at play than just the convenience of the military judge and the time spent in court. As the rules for court-martial and military rules of evidence make clear, they also intend to avoid the issues of gamesmanship and the issues of trial by ambush. If the court were to allow good cause under these circumstances, it would, in essence, be sanctioning those two very things, which the rules intend to avoid.
Should those factors be taken into account by the judge? That is, whether there's any indication that it's the type of issue that involves the gamesmanship or trial by ambush?
Yes, Your Honor, and Coffin makes that clear.
And so what in this case would indicate that there's any gamesmanship or trial by ambush? That is, all those factors that, it would seem that all those factors that would have led trial defense counsel to have been more aggressive in pursuing this in a pretrial motion would also leave the government understanding that this issue of consent is something that's very significant in this case, and the government's actually going to pursue it in the course of introducing its evidence.
Your Honor, just so it's clear from the government's perspective, the possible gamesmanship or trial by ambush that was going on was from the defense counsel.
Well, I understand that, but in this case, what indication was there that in this particular case there's gamesmanship or trial by ambush? There will be cases in which that's pretty evident to a judge. If it's not evident to a judge, should the absence of those factors be taken into account on good cause?
The absence of those factors should be taken into effect. However, in this case, what we have is, as the military judge pointed out in his ruling, the possibility of gamesmanship, because clearly defense counsel had at his disposal the information. He had Prosecution Exhibit 6. He had access to his client, and yet he sits on his hands idly waiting until trial to take the witness on a voir dire and to begin to examine, just from the witness's perspective, the issue of consent.
To what extent should it be taken into account that the two witnesses involved here were government officials? That is, in terms of good cause, here the defense counsel, without contradiction, contacted government officials. Government officials didn't respond to his contact. Why shouldn't the government be held accountable for their failure to respond to the defense?
Your Honor, what we have in the record is simply a statement from Captain Bowling that he left a phone message. There's no indication that these government actors did, in fact, receive those phone messages. We also have an indication from Captain Bowling that he went down the day of trial to try to find certain folks down at the MP company during lunchtime.
Again, in the context of good cause, why isn't that attributable to the government? If a defense counsel calls an office of a government official, isn't the government, as an entity, responsible for making sure that the appropriate person gets the message and returns the phone call?
We are, Your Honor, and there's a matter of spectrum here. And again, where are we on the spectrum? Do we have evidence before the court today that these witnesses did in fact receive messages and disregard them? We don't have that. What is before the court is evidence from the trial defense counsel that he left phone messages at an MP company. The court still has its common sense and knowledge of the ways of the world to put that in its perspective. The possibility of phone messages being left does not equate to two government actors refusing to make themselves available. Such as, under those circumstances, perhaps that would be good cause, Your Honor.
I mean, it seems from the defense counsel's cross-examination with respect to the traffic scene that he was talking to someone at the military police.
Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, I guess I'm just asking, do you think that it's fair for us to look at the record as a whole to basically say, was there good cause shown to imagine that this person hadn't gotten any cooperation or any help whatsoever when he was conducting effective cross-examination of the government witnesses, and when his theory appeared to be not that the person hadn't had anything to drink, but rather that he wasn't the person driving the car, but rather it was a third person?
Certainly, Your Honor, and there can certainly be a hypothesis formulated based on the record of trial where it seems that perhaps the trial defense counsel, after taking this witness on voir dire, begins to realize that if it's just the narrow questions of what Sergeant Bullock testifies to regarding consent, perhaps he's got some merit on a consent motion. But again, when we look at the totality of the record, we see that there's evidence in there that he was getting government cooperation. It wasn't the government sandbagging him, as it were, suddenly springing Sergeant Bullock on him the day of trial. Appellate Exhibit 3 is the page 43 matters, dated over 2 weeks before trial, dated 16 April, almost 3 weeks before trial. The government makes clear in its page 43 matters that it's going to call Sergeant Bullock as a witness. Incidentally, the defense's page 43 matters also make clear that the defense intended to call Sergeant Luther, the other investigator involved at the scene, the other investigator involved in the hospital, and somewhat tangentially involved in the taking of the blood, Your Honor.
With respect to the voluntariness of the consent and putting aside the issue of implied consent, what's the government's view of what the record shows and does not show with respect to the appellant's ability to consent at the time that the form was placed before him?
What is before the court in the record is a testimony from Sergeant Bullock that when he put Prosecution Exhibit 6 in front of the appellant and he read to him his rights, he was affirmatively told he understood those rights by the appellant. Defense counsel on appeal has tried to indicate that perhaps he was under some medication, perhaps he was suffering from a broken jaw. Now, the record does disclose Sergeant Bullock was told by nurses that he was suspected of having a broken jaw. That's why he was in the x-ray room. But we invite the court's attention back to the questions. The question of counsel is not evidence before the court, and that's what we have here.
What does the record show about medication or his state of consumption of alcohol at the time the consent form was placed before him?
What we have is questions from the defense counsel, leading questions. Sergeant Bullock, and I don't have it right in front of me, but Sergeant Bullock, do you know, did he have any medication? The answer is, I don't know. Basically, he didn't ask. There's not an affirmative piece of evidence before the court stating that he was, in fact, on medication, stating that he was, in fact, unable to appreciate his rights based on the possible physical injury. There's evidence that he was beat up from the wreck, Sergeant Bullock's words, that he was being x-rayed for a possible broken jaw, and there's evidence before the court that the appellant told the military police officer he understood the rights as they were being read to him, and then he signed the form.
What about his blood alcohol level?
And his blood alcohol level is a factor to consider. At the time, it came back as a 0.11, and that is a factor, but again, as the case is cited by the government in our brief, that is not the only factor involved. But the government concedes that having a 0.11 is a factor that a court would have to consider in determining whether his will was overcome by his alcohol.
Is there any case that would stand for the proposition that blood alcohol level is unnecessarily impairing?
No, Your Honor.
Let me ask you a slightly different question, counsel. If the evidence of the blood alcohol content is not correctly in the record, if we said, well, this search was unreasonable, what other evidence is there in the record that the appellant was intoxicated to the point of legal intoxication or to the blood alcohol content of 0.11 that's in the specification?
Your Honor, there's a number of pieces in the record we invite your attention to. However, it's not absolutely determinative as the scientific evidence that the court, under its hypothesis, would be excluding. For instance, you've got the testimony of Lance Corporal Schmidt at page 28, where Lance Corporal Schmidt, the appellant's friend who was in the accident with him, explains that he witnessed the appellant drinking alcohol that night, and that when they went to the party, their intent was they were not going to drive because they planned on drinking so much that they should not be driving. We also have the testimony of, or excuse me, the statement of the appellant himself, found in prosecution exhibit 5. He admits that he arrived at the party between 2030 and 2100 and began drinking beer, and then around midnight he went across the street and began drinking vodka and Jägermeister. Again, reinforced by Lance Schmidt's testimony that also confirms that he was aware of the appellant drinking Jägermeister that night. On top of that, you've got the testimony of Sergeant Luther, Sergeant Bullock, who testified that at least six hours after the accident, they could still smell alcohol on the appellant at the hospital. And finally, we have the testimony of one of the hunters who came by, who was called by the defense at the end of the trial, who noted that at the scene, he could clearly smell alcohol coming from the occupant that was found on the driver's side, which is, again, when you cross-reference the testimony, it's clearly the appellant. He can't identify the appellant as to which one he found of the two occupants, but it's fairly clear through the totality of the record, Your Honor. If I just may briefly conclude, following the circumstances in this case rises to the level of good cause with strict rules 905, rule of court martial 905 and military rule of evidence 311 of its practical effect. Likewise, the appellant simply fails to bear his burden of showing on a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel. This was a meritorious Fourth Amendment claim. In other words, the evidence was, in fact, inadmissible because it was admissible. As this court stated in Levin, appellant is not entitled to a windfall simply because his counsel failed to object to evidence which is otherwise admissible. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
In dealing with the coffin issue, the government all but concedes that there was ineffective assistance of counsel here, at least the first prong of Strickland is satisfied. And so the central issue here, then, is whether this Fourth Amendment claim would have been meritorious. And as previously discussed and addressed fully in the brief, it would have been. The final question for this court is the one just addressed by the government, is that absent this evidence, this impermissible search, was there enough evidence to prove that appellant was legally intoxicated and that he was driving this vehicle? And there simply is not upon this record. Alcohol on someone's breath does not constitute evidence alone of intoxication. And if you want to look to Schmerber itself for that, you will see that there were certain other indicators that were taken. If you look at the Michigan v. Sloan case, which is cited in the appellant's brief, you also have a law enforcement officer performing field sobriety tests, noting glassy eyes, a whole number of other factors. There simply is not that level of evidence in this case to prove that appellant was driving this vehicle while intoxicated beyond a reasonable doubt.
In that context, is a 0.11 blood alcohol level necessarily indicative of a person's inability to consent?
Your Honor, per se, it is not. And that is why appellant puts together the totality of the circumstances in this case, which suggests that appellant was incapable of consent. If you look at the questions that trial defense counsel had to have a good faith basis to ask, those dealing with the broken jaw, the medication, he obviously knows that information, and again has to have a good faith basis to ask those questions. That, in concert with the inducement issue, with the North Carolina rights advisement, which was inapplicable, in concert with the appellant's level of intoxication, makes this consent invalid. If there are no further questions.
How do we know if the North Carolina rights advisement is valid or not valid?
Your Honor,
has that been litigated? Is there case law in this court addressing?
You will find case law in the federal circuits dealing with special maritime jurisdiction DUI cases that will say that state procedural and evidentiary rules, such as implied consent statutes, are not applicable and that you should look to the federal implied consent statute. Unfortunately, I don't have any of those at hand. I would prepare to file a 36A letter.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, and we thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today. The court will stand in recess until 9 a.m. tomorrow morning.
Court stands in recess until 9 a.m.